You know, there's a term that's commonly used in this path called duality. Like, we live in duality. That's kind of where we all come from. And by that, what we mean is that the place that it seems like we've been in all our lives, there's a me in here, right, of a limited awareness. Like, I can see, I don't know what you're thinking, but I know what I'm thinking. I don't know what you're feeling or what the people next door are feeling, but I know what's going on here. And the mind has this way of everything that is experienced, it puts the word me to it. There's an experience of a full bladder. And the mind says, I need to go to the bathroom. Or there's an experience of cold, and the mind will say, I'm cold, or experience of irritation comes up and it's, I'm irritated. So this process, which Adyashanti has a term called the ego-identified mind, the mind that identifies its experience as having a me or an I, we could call it the me-identified mind, seems to be the game in town. It's where we live. And it creates this sense where there's a me in here, and then everything else seems to be out there. You all seem to be out there. So there's an outside and an inside, a subjective and an objective. And that sense of two-ness is duality. Does it make sense? And in a way, sometimes I can remember being impatient with that term because I thought, well, where else is there? I will never know what you're thinking, Julie, you know? I mean, it's just how it is. And so what's the point? And the thing is, being in this me-identified, inside-outside dual living, it's uncomfortable as all get out, isn't it? It's hard to live in it. It's constantly craving. It wants better view, more comfort, more ease. It's looking for something that it can't seem to get more than for a moment. You know, maybe there's a moment where you're having a wonderful time and everything seems wonderful, but it changes, right? Then the next day the bills are due and you got to go back to work and it's sleeting again outside, and so you're back to that. It's uncomfortable. So we live in this duality, and it's hard. It's uncomfortable. It's why when you look at all the pain and stuff going on in the world, this is the source of it, right? The sense of I'm uncomfortable and it's me in here and you out there. That's the dilemma that brings us to a spiritual practice of any kind, correct? So from that point of view where that's all we know, the obvious thing that we want a spiritual practice to do is to make us more comfortable. I've got to change what's going on in here so that it's easier to live, right? If I'm having critical thoughts, I want to replace them with loving thoughts. If I'm irritated with my kids, I want to be patient with my kids. So from that viewpoint, as much as we try not to, we come to this practice as kind of a self-improvement project, right? Because that's all that makes sense to the me-identified point of life. I have to be a better person. I need to be, but the reason why it doesn't work is the me that thinks it needs to change is the problem. The duality is the problem. So it can't change itself. Or it's not by changing itself that's going to find the answer. And it takes a long, long time to burn through the idea, because hope springs eternal, that I'm going to make myself better to the point where my life is going to be happy. And I heard something in somebody, it might have been an article or some comment someone made in the last week, that Sigmund Freud said that his work of therapy that he came up with, the point of that was to move us from neurosis, which is where we're living with a lot of conflict because life can be traumatic to us in many ways, to a point of ordinary unhappiness was the goal of therapy. Maybe you said that.
He said common misery.
Common misery. Yeah. And so part of me is like, it's amazing we have as many therapists as we do, because that's not very encouraging. But he's right, because it brings you to a point of balanced duality. And it's inherently unrestful. You know, and the reason is, well, let me just say this. So when we come to practice, our first job is we start developing this sense of accompaniment or witness or observer that can see this whole flood of ordinary unhappiness passing by, which is the first noble truth. It's that life is painful and we resist it, so it feels bumpy and uneven. So our first point in practice is we sit with something that can just see it. And the second training that we do as we do this, and this certainly is our experience a lot in meditation, is to be able to just sit with that instead of checking out from it, right? Because normally when we feel something uncomfortable, we check out in some fashion. And in this current world we live in, where there's entertainment at our fingertips at every second of the day, it's so easy to turn on the radio, check your email, your Instagram account, whatever it is, it's so easy to check out in some way, which is just the Buddhist term for this, the desire for non-existence. I don't want to experience this. So a lot of our practice, which is not easy, is I am willing to experience this. I'm willing to see this. And what starts coming up in practice is that we can see that the part of us that can stay present with or can witness this is not actually experiencing all this discomfort. It can just see the whole catastrophe, you know, the train wreck happening, so to speak. It can see it. And in that space that can see it, something begins to open for us. There's another possibility of just being present with it. And the thing that happens is that, because from the egoic point of view, the only thing that's possible is to fix it. From this point of awareness, the point is to be present with it. And we find that just spending time with that that's uncomfortable, it changes our relationship with it. So, but what the long point of this whole thing is, and I alluded to it in the lead into this practice, is when we sit with something and we surrender to it, we don't check out, we don't avoid, we don't give in to the craving, we just see it happening. Something begins to open. Something that actually is not dual. It doesn't feel separated. There's no inside or outside. There's no me or you. There's something that begins to open. It feels, we don't see it because it's so invisible, it's so quiet, and it has no voice of its own, unlike the voice in our head. It has no voice of its own, begins to subtly shine. And it's kind of analogous to the fish trying to figure out what water is. It's surrounded by it. It's in us. It's in every cell of our bodies, but we can't see it because of its invisibility, because it has no personality, no opinion, no right or wrong, but it starts to open up. And at some point, it becomes a different place to live from. First, we see little pieces of it comes in on little cat's feet, but eventually, we just begin to feel there's an ease somewhere. There's an ease, there's a peacefulness somewhere. And it takes a little faith to believe it's there, but it's what's in your bones. It's the ground of who you are. It's the truth of your being. So it catches us. But the question is, for a long time I heard that and I thought, well, that brochure sounds great, but how do I get there? Meanwhile, I'm here, you know, living my dual life. So I just wanted to offer a couple of things because it takes a while for that to begin to open. But it is what is calling you to practice. It is. I mean, Rumi has this great poem about, I'm trapped in a prison for drunks. It is what is saying there's something beyond that prison for drunks. And then Rumi's second part of the other part of the poem is, I don't know how I got here, but whoever brought me here is going to have to take me home. So it's like relying on something that's not me doing. And that's scary to do. That's beyond your own dual agency. So it takes a bit of surrendering and trusting. But it's a gradual process, and we begin to sort of feel its flavor a little bit. We begin to sense it from time to time. So I want to give you some operating instructions for the meanwhile, the purgatory, because frankly, this process of waking up from it is a long work, and it's like a step forward, half a step back, a step forward, half a step back for most of us. And the first step is it's really important at our stage in practice to know the taste of the ego-identified mind. You know how like you wake up in the morning and you're excited about the day and the sun's shining and you go out and a half an hour later you're stuck in traffic and you're thinking about the project that's not going well at work and you feel like you're in this tight, uncomfortable space again. You know that feeling? That's the ego-identified space. It has contraction, is its signature. And what's really important in our practice isn't fixing it, but recognizing it. That's our work right now. Is when that tightness comes or you're going along and you hear something on the radio or you see something or somebody makes a comment to you and things starts to go off inside, you know, you start to like, oh, to recognize it. That's the ego-identified mind. Our work is to go, I know what this is. I see it. Not to change it, not to fix it, but to recognize it, to know that taste. And as you know it more and more, it comes quicker and quicker. You can catch it right at the beginning. Oh, there it is. A person made that comment. It's reminding me of something that I'm not feeling very good about. And so everything's starting to go sideways inside. That's the space. That's the space. So we recognize it. And the second thing we do is we don't try to fix it. We just give it space. And I've said this a bunch of times, but as I learned this as a parent, it's like if that uncomfortableness was coming to you like it was a small child, and you just say, I got you, honey. The child is worried or crying or anxious, and you just say, I've got you. Because the part of us that's the observer is bigger than anything that could come into our minds or our bodies. So it's like, I have you. Cry as long as you need to. Stay here as long as you need to. I have you. So we stop fixing. And the third thing that comes up from that eventually, when we see this enough, and we recognize the taste enough, we recognize that fixing the ego, the dual mind, the ego-identified mind, will never work. It's not what we're here about, but it takes a long time to see it clearly. It's a hopeless task. Trying to fix your person, your ego-identified mind to find happiness or peace that's going to last beyond a circumstance, you got to hang that one up. But it takes a long time to burn that out. But when you start seeing it over and over again by recognizing it and spending time with it, you realize, God, this is like trying to push back the tide with a broom. I'm working as hard as I can and as fast as I can, and it's tiring. And your first, as there's a book that came out many years ago by Trungpa Rinpoche called The Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. Many of you might be familiar. And he sets it up great, and then there's no solution. And where he gets to is when you recognize the hopelessness of trying to perfect or wake up the ego-identified part of yourself, that's your first coin of real spiritual value. You stop digging in that blind alley. And when you stop digging in that blind alley, another possibility becomes open because you're not digging so hard. You can actually stop digging and look up and see what else is there. So I just want to I just wanted to say that. I said this to a continuing class later this week, and it's not an easy thing to hear. But there's water. There is water, there is peace, there is a place where the mind is quiet and you feel the whole world is inside you. And it's waiting for us. But meanwhile, we're continuing to root through a different pile of stuff, thinking we'll find it, and we just need to stop. This is about stopping doing. And there's a point in your meditation with this where even the meditator has to stop. And it's just you being their opening to this larger thing. And it comes in. The other thing is it's in our lives already, but we don't see it because we're so caught up in what we're struggling with. And we don't see it because it's what is working in our lives. It's what we're not struggling with. It's the places where we just know what to do. Might be a touch of a hand or a comment or a call or something that we know to do and we just do it. And there's a real sense of flow and peace in it, right? So the other part besides recognizing the taste, the contracted taste of the ego-identified mind, is noticing those moments of flow. Noticing them, because whatever you notice is going to increase. And then you might even offer yourself more as a practice of the things that actually bring you to that place. For some of us, it might be a walk in nature. It might be getting out a little bit more. For me, it happens to be the art museum is one place. And I try to get out there to offer myself that. Or being with those you love, or taking a walk with your dog, whatever it is. But to notice those places of flow and then spend a little bit more time there. So you're trusting this process. And eventually what happens is there's a shift. I mean, the first shift is where we shift from thinking where everything that comes up in the mind and the body to realizing we're the observer. That's closer to the center of who we are. And then the second shift is we're the observer because it makes the mind, all this digging, it makes it a little bit less opaque, where that opens up to this bigger something that can come in. So I just wanted to share that with you because we do spend a lot of time in these tight places going, is there water here? Or is this, you know, is there? There is. And the trick to getting there is to stop trying to change or fix it. Just being with it and let that big wind, whoever brought me here that's going to take me home, let that wind take it for you. So I don't know if that leaves you edified or mystified. Either one is okay.